A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 124. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Woman in Black. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello.
What is the secret of Eel Marsh House? And who is The Woman in Black? This was a 100-minute TV movie, a ghost story, not surprisingly, that was broadcast on ITV in 1989.
Indeed, and it's based on a famous novel by the author Susan Hill of the same name, The Woman in Black, and it's been adapted for television by a British Invaders favourite name, Bing, if you're playing the bingo game at home. It's been adapted by Nigel Neal, so one of our favourite writers here, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. Two interesting writers involved. So the setup of The Woman in Black involves a young lawyer, Arthur Kidd, in the 1920s in London, and he is sent by his firm to go to close up the estate and all of the legal matters for a client who has recently died. And this is when we're introduced to Mrs. Drablow, who is this client who's recently died, and she lived in Eel Marsh House, which is well away from civilization. And we learn something about a long journey that it takes to go out to this location where Arthur Kidd will have to go to look at Mrs. Drablow's papers. And we get this journey to this remote location.
That's right, Eel Marsh House. I don't think it's ever specified exactly what part of the country it's in, but it's obviously coastal and in marshland. And to get out to this isolated Eel Marsh House, you have to travel over a causeway, which goes across a very treacherous area of marshland, and the causeway floods from time to time. And as soon as young Mr. Kidd arrives in the town of Cruthin Gifford, he finds that the residents are very suspicious of him and his task, and they're extremely twitchy about Eel Marsh House and its former owner. There's certainly, we can detect from their responses to him, there's certainly something going on, and there's some sort of mystery about Eel Marsh House and Mrs. Drablow.
Yes, absolutely. We get this idea that Cruthin Gifford is basically a farming village, and it is very remote itself. And then Eel Marsh House is very isolated, even compared to Cruthin Gifford. It is across this causeway, and you can only travel to Eel Marsh House when the tide is low. So it becomes clear that it is very remote indeed. I believe in the novel they were a little bit more specific about where Cruthin Gifford was, because they specified which train stations you would have to transfer through in order to get the train to Cruthin Gifford. And there were two or three stations you would have to go through to transfer before getting from London all the way there. So that gave us a little bit more about where it was located.
Okay, so some geographical clues in the original novel. And here in the television version, we've got Arthur Kidd then moving on to attend Mrs. Drablow's funeral in Cruthin Gifford. And he goes along with the local solicitor, who's sort of their agent in the area for dealing with Mrs. Drablow's affairs. And there they are at the funeral, pretty much the only people attending, Brian.
Yes, that's right. Mrs. Drablow was something of a recluse, so there were really no mourners there. There were these two people from the law firm dealing with her estate, but they did see one other person at the funeral, or at least Arthur Kidd saw one other person, and that was A Woman in Black.
Dun, dun, dun. So there we are, into the title character. So let's talk about the other characters in this TV version. We have got, as we've mentioned, Arthur Kidd, played by an actor called Adrian Rawlins, who interestingly would go on to play James Potter, that's Harry Potter's father, in the Harry Potter movies. And here he is playing this young lawyer who has to leave behind his wife and young children for his trip to Crithin Gifford. So an interesting portrayal right at the centre of our programme.
Yes, and then we quite soon get Sam Tuvey, played by Bernard Hepton, who was in Secret Army and Colditz. And he plays a wealthy landowner who befriends Kid very early on. They actually meet on the train to Crithin Gifford. And we learn that Sam Tuvey has been buying up a great deal of land in the area of Crithin Gifford.
And then another solicitor is Arnold Pepperell. He's the local agent for the firm. He lives in Crithin Gifford, played by the actor John Cater. And he's been acting as their agent. And he is the other person who goes to the funeral with Arthur Kidd. But he, again, is very suspicious of Arthur Kidd, and he's very nervous about the house and the late Mrs. Drablow. And he sort of, I think, early on gives us this feeling from Crithin Gifford itself that something is not right. And Arthur Kidd detects that there's a certain degree of fear and trepidation.
We also have Keckwick, played by William Simons, who is a local man in Crithin Gifford who is actually quite quiet, doesn't interact all that much, but he has been hired to drive Arthur Kidd to Ealmarsh House. The drive to Ealmarsh House cannot be done with a car or even a full-size horse and cart. It's such a small, awkward causeway. It requires a little pony and trap, and that is how Arthur Kidd gets to the house and back with Keckwick's help.
And I think we're told that Keckwick is pretty much the only person who will go out to Ealmarsh House. Nobody else from Crithin Gifford will go there.
That's right. He had been helping Mrs. Drablow and supplying her with food and items she needed. He was the one who would bring things.
And that just leaves one other character who obviously is the title of the piece, the Woman in Black herself. Can't say too much about her, apart from the fact that she was played by the actress Pauline Moran, who is probably most recognised for playing Poirot's secretary in the long-running Poirot TV series. And here she is as the character, the Woman in Black herself.
Yes, very spooky. Now, as we get into this a little bit more, after Arthur Kidd sees this woman at the funeral, there is an accident in the market square on market day when farmers are coming in and things are being bought and sold, and there is a cart with lumber on it, then there is a collapse and things tumble out of place, and you see the situation where a small child very nearly dies, and Arthur Kidd actually saves this child from being crushed, and you know, quite nearly is crushed himself, but everyone is safe, but very much shaken. And the people in the town seem to take notice of this happening quite a bit.
Okay, so we've got him arriving in Crithin Gifford. We've got the funeral we've mentioned. We have the incident in the market square. And then inevitably, we have a visit to Ealmarsh House itself, where he finds there is so much paperwork and so much work to be done on wrapping up her affairs that he decides the only way to deal with us is for him to actually stay in Ealmarsh House, something which isn't very popular with Keckwick and other members of the local community. But Arthur Kidd is undaunted, and he feels that his best thing for him to do is to stay there and work.
He had been warned about how much work it would be to go through all of Mrs. Drablow's papers, because she kept so much of her things, and she had things from decades there. But of course, when he actually sees it, it was more than even he had guessed. We also find that in this area of Crithin Gifford, they have the phenomenon of sea frets, or just frets, which are sea mists that blow in and make it very hard to see and to get around. And in fact, when a sea fret comes in, you cannot cross the causeway to get to Ealmarsh House or to get back from Ealmarsh House. And in addition, the causeway is underwater during high tide. So we find that the ability to get out there and to get back is actually quite restricted in terms of when you can do it.
So there he is, Arthur Kidd, isolated and cut off in Neil Marsh House, trying to diligently work through her papers. But inevitably, I suppose, various things happen to interfere with his work. And in particular, he hears noises coming from the marshes. And while one of these sea frets or mists is down, he hears or seems to hear the noise of a horse and cart on the path, on the causeway, and then the horse and cart apparently getting into trouble, and there are cries and screams, and in particular the cries of a child, with Arthur Kidd being unable to identify exactly where they're coming from or what's going on.
And he's also in risk of losing himself in this mist and not being able to find his way. And on top of this, in the house itself, he is hearing whispered voices and things banging and sort of unexplained sounds. And he sees a locked door, and he has this full set of keys that should handle everything, and he is just unable to open this one door.
So, as you've probably guessed, as we've been discussing this, if you haven't seen this television show, we are dealing very much with the sort of genre of a haunted house, Brian. We have quite a spooky place, and we have some spooky noises and comings and goings, and all the mysteries and sort of suspense of a haunted house drama.
Yes, absolutely. And it fits into the sort of tradition of the Victorian ghost stories, even though it is later than that. And, of course, while Arthur Kidd is at this house, he's looking through all of these papers, and he is starting to discover some of the history of the Drablow family, of Mrs. Drablow herself, was Alice Drablow, and of her husband and some other relatives. So it was interesting to see how things develop from there.
Yes, it is. And I mean, we perhaps mention here that one of the things he discovers is an old wax recording machine that records on wax cylinders, and that Mrs. Drablow has actually made some recordings herself. And that enables us to actually hear her and hear some of the story from the deceased Mrs. Drablow herself. And that's quite a little clever device for the TV show, I think.
Was it a wax recorder or a wire recorder?
Good question. I think it was certainly one of the early recording machines anyway.
Yes, it was recording on cylinders that were either wax or they were wire spool cylinders. In any case, he had these audio recordings of Mrs. Drablow talking about things that were happening, and he was also able to go and make audio recordings of his own. So we get some of this happening, and that
now,
plays into things as well.
Now I have to trust you with an important assignment.
Oh?
Be assured I'd have dealt with it myself, but for other commitments.
What is it?
You know the Drablow estate?
Well, heard of it.
It's been my personal concern, of course. With this firm for half a century, Mr. Drablow was a China trader. He died out east many years ago, and we've looked after things ever since. Now his widow has just passed away, age 72. Now, I want you to attend the funeral.
Of course.
The day after tomorrow.
Where will it be?
Ah.
In London?
No, it's at a place called Trithin Gifford, the little market town on the coast. You'll go by train, of course.
I understand.
No, you don't. Not yet. You're to stay on and clear things up. Sort out Mrs. Drablow's effects and any documents. Retrieve all private
Okay,
papers,
let's turn to our production notes. And let's first of all talk about Susan Hill, the author, one of our sort of most well-known British authors, particularly dealing with ghost stories. Well known for being interested in classic sort of traditional ghost stories, such as those of M.R. James and Daphne du Maurier. And here she is publishing The Woman in Black in 1983, probably her most successful and well-known book, Brian.
It probably is, but she certainly has published things over quite a large span of time. I Am the King of the Castle was 1970, and then The Man in the Picture was actually 2007. There was also The Small Hand in 2010. And she had a series of detective novels featuring Simon Seraglio as well. So she has written quite a variety of things over quite a number of years.
Okay, so an interesting author, and her most famous book, very well-known ghost story, as I say, coming out in the early 80s.
Central Television was one of the ITV companies, one of quite a few, and it purchased the rights to do The Woman in Black.
And they approached Nigel Neal to adapt it for the screen. And, you know, we've talked about Nigel Neal on many an occasion, Brian. I suppose best known for Quatermass, but also for productions like 1984 and The Stone Tape and several others that we've discussed here on British Invaders in the past.
Yes, he certainly had an interest in ghost stories and sort of redefining ghost stories, as we certainly know from Quatermass and the Pit, and also from the Stone Tape.
And he'd actually, at this stage in his career, he'd been away from television for a while because he'd been working not altogether successfully in Hollywood, and in particular on the fiasco that was Halloween 3, which is, I think, a fairly well-known story of his conflicts with John Carpenter and how the script wasn't what he really intended. But anyway, so he'd come back to television after that, and here he is being approached by Central Television to adapt Susan Hill's novel.
And Nigel Neal, I think this was something he was really happy to do, to work with this. And he actually wrote the script for it in about 10 days. And his agent said, well, don't submit it to them yet, because they might think it was rushed and just done quickly and not very good because of that. So he waited a little while to submit it to Central TV. And it was about 3 weeks later when he did bring it to the TV company. And at that point, they were almost ready to shelve the production because it was taking so long.
Yes, some strange advice from his agent, and also slightly cold feet from Central Television, who apparently thought got the impression that Nigel Neal might be too old for the task they had set him. At this stage, he was 67, and they wondered whether the delay in him turning the script was because he couldn't manage it anymore. So sort of like an odd little mix-up there between Neal and his agent and the television company that almost stop this coming to the screen.
To put things into perspective, Nigel Neal was 67 at the time. He lived into his 80s and was very much on top of things all the way through, and was script consultant, I think, on the 2005 Quatermass Experiment remake.
So, still very active, and he turned in his script, and it was obviously accepted and handed over to the director, Herbert Wise, who is probably best known on British television for directing I, Claudius, which of course featured a whole host of star names, including Derek Jacobi and Brian Blessed. So he must have had an interesting task managing the direction of that. And here he is directing this Woman in Black adaptation in 1989 for Central TV.
I, Claudius is considered to be one of the big highlights of British television altogether. So having the director from that indicates that Central TV was serious about doing this well. So it was filmed on OC Island on a river estuary in Essex, and they had some quite bleak locations in it, including a rather desolate graveyard. And the locations that were used in this really sort of played things up, I think.
It does. It looks great. I mean, the London scenes look good. And then when we switch to Crithin Gifford and to Eel Marsh House, it all looks suitably atmospheric and spooky and period. It's very well done, I think. The locations and the sets were well chosen. And then on top of that, we've got some very atmospheric music composed for the TV show by Rachel Portman. And including, I think, at some dramatic moments, something that almost sounds like the Psycho violins. It's that sort of sudden, insistent violin sort of sharp music to punctuate certain key moments in the drama.
The sound design does seem to have a little bit of that tradition that you saw many years earlier in Psycho and things of that type.
And then, of course, we've got, you know, for a haunted house story, we've got lots of spooky sounds in and around the house itself. So all sort of pulling together this rather impressive production.
And we had an original broadcast on Christmas Eve of 1989. So this is yet another entry into the tradition of Christmas ghost stories. Often those are on the BBC, but in this case, it was a Christmas time ghost story broadcast on ITV. So it's always nice to see things fitting in with that tradition. And it was actually quite successful in terms of the viewership, the ratings, and also the critical success as well. It was reviewed quite well.
Yes, absolutely. And it was even nominated for the British Academy of Film and Television Awards. So it was nominated for 4 BAFTAs in the categories of sound and makeup and music and design. I don't know if it actually won any of those awards, but it was certainly, as you say, this was a sort of well-regarded show that was a critical and a rating success, and as you say, another Christmas ghost story on television, which is great.
And it actually got a Christmas repeat, didn't it?
Yes, it's been repeated once, and again, that was on Christmas, and this time it was on Channel 4, and that was 1994, so 5 years after the original broadcast, it gets another airing.
Interesting. So let's move right into some coverage of the availability of this. We decided we should try doing availability in the first half of our discussion to give people a bit more of a chance to watch it before the second half comes up. And that's based on a listener suggestion or two. And unfortunately, we have to report that the availability for this is really not very good.
Yes, it's a shame, really. I mean, here we are talking about this show and moving the availability section into this first part, but not currently available. There is a complicated rights issue about who owns the broadcast and the reproduction rights for this TV show. And we believe that it may actually be the film company responsible for the more recent film version, the 2012 film version, who actually owned the TV rights, which may explain, I suppose, why it's not been more recently available or broadcast, Brian.
Yes, it has been released in the past. It was released on VHS, and it was re-released on a small market DVD, a Region 1 DVD, that was a licensed DVD, but was a very small release that was a very simple release that just had the copy of the show itself on it. But there have been those releases in the past.
Unfortunately, they're both now deleted and they're rather hard to find in the second-hand marketplace and therefore somewhat expensive. Although you can get hold of it on Amazon.co.uk in the Amazon marketplace. And most recently, the price I saw was about £20. So it is just about available, but slightly tricky to get hold of here in the UK.
Yes, and it's very expensive on Amazon.com, and it isn't listed on Amazon.ca at all. So it is a little tricky to get a hold of it. It may be that if you want to get that released DVD, that it would be cheaper to import it from the UK.
Okay, but if you know anything more about the rights issue, and particularly as to who owns the TV rights, do jump in on our Facebook page and let us know. It'd be interesting to know more about that.
Yes, absolutely.
However, if you do want to watch it, fortunately, at the time of recording, it is up on YouTube, where it has been split into 7 parts. And the quality of the upload, not too bad, Brian. I mean, there's a few problems, but of course, you do have to sort of jump from one part to the next in order to watch the whole show.
I am hoping that maybe when the recent film is released on DVD, which has not happened yet as of this recording, that maybe they will include as a bonus feature the television version, if indeed they do have the rights. That would be a very nice way to handle it.
That would be a fantastic release, yes. The book, obviously, Susan Hill's novel, is widely available, very easy to get hold of in print, and there's also audiobooks, and it's available, I think, on all the ebook readers. So that's very easy to get hold of.
Yes, that is quite widely distributed, and I think you'll find editions in a variety of countries. So I think that wraps up the first half of our discussion of The Woman in Black. Next time, we will talk more about the mystery of Eel Marsh House, and we will talk about some other adaptations of the book as well. So some interesting points to discuss.
And we have lots of reviews and recommendations to discuss with you, plus some details of the British Invaders field trip.
We may have something there too, yes. So you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you will find us there. We are also part of the Geek Culture Network, so if you look at thegeekculturenetwork.com, we are there as well. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much, and until next time, this is Eamon in England, also signing off.